Hello, and welcome to Mental Health Matters Podcast. I'm your host, Liz Lang, and I'm here with Dr. Mark Burton. In this podcast, we will talk about all things mental health. Thank you so much for joining us. Hey guys, Liz Lang here with Dr. Mark Burton, and this week we are going to get into cognitive dissonance, which is probably not something you have heard at all, but is actually pretty common. So we'll start off by explaining what it is.
I think it is very common, but most people wouldn't know the name or the term, probably, that may be in a movie where they talked about it. So cognitive dissonance is mental discomfort that results from holding two conflicting beliefs or values or attitudes. I think it can also be a behavior, for instance, or like a belief contrasted with a behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just caused that discomfort. I've probably mentioned this before. I really believe that the brain tries very hard to be consistent, to have that internal consistency. Often the way I talk about it with couples is that the brain tries very hard to have consistent beliefs and then behaviors. And so, you know, we'll talk about how that ties into cognitive dissonance. So the dissonance means there's a disconnect between either two beliefs or how we believe and how we're behaving.
Right. And so there's a common example that you often hear of smoking. You know,
it's a good example. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So, you know, you hear that smoking is bad. And so you start to believe, yeah, smoking is bad. And so you're uncomfortable with the idea of smoking because it's bad for your health. So you decide to quit. Well, then quitting is genuinely hard to quit. And so you don't quit. And so you rationalize to yourself, well, smoking isn't that bad for your health, or, you know, what difference does it really make? So you want your values and your beliefs to align with your actions.
Mm-hmm. I think one that a lot of people could really connect with is around dieting and what we eat. It's the same type of thing. I hope there are fewer people who smoke now.
Yeah.
50 years ago, I hope. But, you know, in a culture such as ours, there's hundreds of thousands of people who are on diets at any time. But the cognitive dissonance that you feel, or the discomfort from, I know I shouldn't have that brownie, but I'm going to anyway. You know, you rationalize that in your head. Same thing could be said around like exercise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know exercise is really good for us. I should do that. But then you rationalize the reason to not get out of bed. It just feels too good to sleep in for a half hour. And so I hear those rationalizations all the time in the office for people who want to change their behavior. But I think it's also, you know, if you're talking about strictly beliefs, then I think, for example, that, you know, someone who has, say, certain moral beliefs or moral values, and then somehow they rationalize voting for someone who doesn't have those.
Yeah.
I think that's an example of cognitive dissonance. I think the reason that we can talk about it without being too political is that I would guess it applies to both of the major parties in the U.S. And so it's not just singling out one party, but a lot of people do that.
Right. So here's a really good example that I personally had. So when my father-in-law moved in with us, I went back to work. And I originally started working part-time. And then when I went to full-time, I experienced this a lot. You know, just this pull of, I have this job and I enjoy my job. I want to do this job and I want to do well. But I also wanted to be home with my kids. Yeah. And it was a lot of this cognitive dissonance of, I couldn't meld the two. Like, I couldn't get them to connect. And that's why I ended up quitting my job, is because I missed my kids too much.
Yeah.
You know, it was more important for me to be a mom because my kids are still young. Mm-hmm. I mean, my youngest was, I think, 4. No, he was 3. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was about 3, you know, at the time that I started working. And, you know, or actually he was like 2.5. And so, you know, I wanted to be mom more than I wanted to work, and it just wasn't working. And so I experienced that cognitive dissonance. And as a result, I quit my job. You know, it's something that we all experience.
I was going to just go over a couple of signs that you might experience where you could say, okay, this is some cognitive dissonance going on, feeling uncomfortable about doing something or making a decision, which is what you just described, trying to justify or rationalize a decision that you've made or an action, feeling embarrassed or ashamed about something you've done, trying to hide your action from other people, experience guilt or regret about something you've done in the past, doing things for social pressure. And I think, you know, it'd be interesting to talk to adolescents. I don't have any adolescents in my practice right now, or, you know, family, of course. But it'd be interesting to see if they feel what we're describing as cognitive dissonance because of pressure from peer groups. Because that's pretty common for adolescents.
Yeah. Right. Well, and, you know, another thing is I think that teens and young adults who are, you know, they're trying to become autonomous from their parents and they're discovering their own beliefs. And so I would imagine that they feel it quite often because for so long, we just, as children, they just automatically kind of take on the beliefs of their parents, right? They believe whatever their parents believe because it's all they know. And they just kind of assume that their parents are right. And then as they grow up and they form their own opinions, that's got to be really just discomforting or uncomfortable to sit here and say, well, wait a minute, are my parents' beliefs right? Do I believe what my parents believe?
Yeah.
And, you know, they have to make that choice.
Yeah, I can give you an example. This is one that stands out to me.
Okay.
So I think a lot of listeners know I used to be an active member of the LDS faith, but I'm not anymore. So years ago, I went up to Seattle and spent a week with the Gottman, who we often talk about, John and Julie Gottman, pretty seminar. And so in Seattle, they're very proud of their coffee. And, you know, as an active LDS member, I'd never had coffee before. And anyway, I'd been, you know, out of the church for several years. And I thought, oh, I'm going to have some coffee. And man, did I experience that cognitive dissonance for the first few times. I thought, what is this strange feeling in my head? Like I was doing something really awful. So that's one of the ways I experienced cognitive dissonance.
Well, because for so many years,
you
were taught coffee is wrong. And
wrong. And then, I mean, what I didn't say is I love coffee. And it was actually, it was like this eye-opening experience. I thought, wow, this is really great. And, you know, they have this, at this conference, they have this big bar set up with coffee all the time because it's Seattle. And
so
they love their coffee.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think Starbucks originated in Seattle. And,
I think Pete might be from up there. Seattle's finest or Seattle's best.
Yeah.
I mean, there.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it is a big deal. I grew up in that area, and coffee is like, there's a coffee corner in there's a coffee shop in every corner. It's just commonplace. Okay. So I want to talk briefly about kind of values and morals and where they originate. So, or at least talk about the amygdala, right? And so the amygdala is a small structure in the brain, which is responsible for a myriad of things. And Mark being the expert, I'll let you explain that.
So I think that as you know, neuroscientists, part of their job, they try to isolate what parts of the brain are responsible for either certain emotions or thoughts or, you know, behaviors. And it's really hard to do that. And as we've talked about before, it's probably highly unlikely that anything comes from just one area of the brain because it's so complex. I mean, it's amazingly complex and connected. And so when I think about morals, so that you can think about it in a couple of ways. You're asking specifically probably mostly about the formation of moral values. You can also think of it in terms of what is it that regulates behavior that goes along with your moral values. So behavior, I think that, again, there are many areas. I'm not going to say this is the only area, but the frontal lobes are certainly very important in regulating any type of behavior. I mean, a lot of people call them putting the brakes on behavior that we shouldn't do. So I think where the amygdala comes in is with a lot of moral value, you can imagine there's a high emotional content. Say, for instance, that when you're developing morals, say as an adolescent or child, one of the things you want to be experiencing is empathy. And so you have this range of emotions, empathy, sadness, you see that my behavior does this. And I think it's one of the ways that we develop a more, say, a moral code. And so I think the way that the limbic system, so the amygdala is part of the limbic system, that one of the maybe the most important ways is in its regulation, or its the way it helps us with emotion. Mm-hmm. And so I think with morality, or the formation of morality, there's a very big emotional content.
And yes.
So that's what I think its main contribution.
And so my understanding too of the amygdala is it does serve an important function in the body in terms of, so it's your amygdala that won't allow you to swallow poison, right?
Okay, right.
And so...
Oh, you know who talked about this at one time was Robert Sapolsky.
Yeah. Yeah.
You remember? Yeah.
Yeah. And so oftentimes, you know, people can have an amygdalary response if there's something abhorrent. So, you know, in general, most people would think of just abusing an animal. That's probably going to elicit some sort of amygdalary, like that's going to elicit a feeling of disgust inside.
Right.
Of,
so that's the emotion, right? The very strong emotional response.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I thought it would be interesting to talk about why people don't experience cognitive dissonance all the time, right? This idea that we can believe different things and be comfortable of experiencing different beliefs. You know, a good example is, I mean, I think religion is probably a pretty good example. I mean, people mm-hmm. have different religious beliefs and, you know, not everybody believes in the same religion. So what are your thoughts on this?
Well, so I do have thoughts. But tell me, how does the religious piece, because you're talking about why don't people have their own cognitive dissonance more often?
Yeah.
And, you know, the thought that entered my head when you asked the question is, what makes you think they don't? Because that's, I think that, like, the examples we gave mm-hmm. are pretty common. I don't know that anyone would say, oh, yeah, I'm experiencing cognitive dissonance. I think it's one of the things that we might experience and not realize we're experiencing.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, probably.
And I think you have to be pretty self-aware to realize you're doing something you're uncomfortable with. And I think that it might be maybe a problem with words or terms that we're using, that if people were aware, oh, this is cognitive dissonance, I'm feeling uncomfortable, you'd probably get a lot more people thinking, yeah, I experienced that.
That's true.
So yeah. I think it's a lack of knowledge of what it is that's going on. Here's the other thing that I think about that I've said before, that I think self-esteem is really based on, is your self-concept mm-hmm. in line with your behavior? So okay. when you think about that, we all have a self-concept. Mm-hmm. We think, okay, I'm a moral person, or I'm a smart person, or something like that, or I'm a kind person. But what if our behavior does not indicate we're a kind person? Like if we're unkind to someone, then I think that's an example of how someone might experience cognitive dissonance. So if you see yourself as a kind person, you're going down the road, you know, and you flip off the guy next to you because he may have not used his turn signal or something, mm-hmm. then that's an example, I think, of cognitive dissonance. So are you really a kind person? You're not behaving like that. And so what I sometimes try and help people understand is that I think if you have that self-concept, you know, where you think of yourself as a kind person, and then you're behaving maybe 100% of the time or 99% of the time as a kind person, I don't think you have cognitive dissonance around that particular issue. And also, the way it ties into self-esteem, I think the closer your behavior gets in alignment with your self-concept, I think the higher your self-esteem is, because you really are behaving as the person you believe you are.
Right. Well, and I think another time that people really probably experience, and I just thought of this as you were talking, cognitive dissonance, is when they cause some sort of inadvertent negative reaction. Like if they do it inadvertently, like they do mm-hmm. something and it has an unintentional negative consequence. Like I'm talking about somebody who maybe isn't paying attention and they cause an accident. That's going to cause a lot of cognitive dissonance. Because you're going to look back and say, I should not have done that. I was doing something wrong. And so, you know, I mean, cognitive dissonance is probably a fancy way of saying guilt, I think.
Well, that's one of the, you know, certainly guilt or embarrassment. But I think, you know, your example of causing an accident, I think most of us think we're probably better drivers than we actually are.
That is but, so true.
You know, you think yourself as a good driver and then you cause an accident. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're not. It goes back to you're not behaving, or you didn't behave in that moment in a way that was in alignment with your self-concept.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. I mean, I'm sure I would experience that. Cause I mean, if I ever got into an accident in the snow, I feel confident driving in the snow. Mm-hmm. Right. But but then again, driving in the snow, like I feel like that's a bit of a wild card. So maybe that's like a complete aside and doesn't even matter. But okay. So here's a question. Mm-hmm. Do you think that cognitive dissonance occurs less often as you age?
Oh, that's a very good question. Here's the reason I think it might. Well, actually, there are a couple of reasons.
Okay.
Now, I'm just going to talk probably from my own experience.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a person of advanced years, you might say. So I think that one thing that happens is we tend to care less what people think about us.
Mm.
At least I do.
You know, that's a good point. I didn't think about cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
Just in terms of we care so much about what people think. We want to be accepted. And that's, mm-hmm. I mean, I guess we did kind of touch on that in terms of peer pressure, but that's a major component, because if you genuinely don't care what people think, then it's not going to bother you.
No. And I find that, you know, now where I, you know, say 10, 20 years ago, I really used to, you know, worry about what people thought about me. I really don't care anymore, mostly.
Yeah.
You still have some of it.
Sure.
But, okay, so there's that piece. I think the other piece is that, you know, life is about learning.
Yep.
Life is about learning how to control your behavior. You know, mm-hmm. you have thoughts, how to control your behavior, what is appropriate in certain situations, what isn't appropriate. And I think as you age, you just get more experience with life. And
right.
so if you're paying attention, mm-hmm. then your behavior should more closely align with your self-concept. At least that's what I found. And maybe, you know, maybe it's going back to that idea of peer pressure or doing what other people think you ought to do. That's a big, heavy component. But I think also it's just experience.
Yeah.
Like I can be in situations and I know that I can't do this or I shouldn't do that just based on previous experience. So I think a lot of it is that. So I would get, in answer to your question, I'll say that, yeah, I think as we age, for a lot of us, we experience less cognitive.
I think what you said makes a lot of sense in terms of as we age, like we become more wise, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we...
Yeah, it's wisdom. You're right.
Yeah, wisdom. But I think that for some people, just when you get old, you get set in your ways too. And maybe that's just not caring anymore, but it's like, you know, once you get older, you're like, I am who I am and I'm not interested in changing.
Well, it could be that, but I've seen a lot of older people who, like in my office, who maybe are unkind
mm-hmm.
to their spouse and they come out with, well, it's just who I am. And I try and point out to them, that is not who you are. It's how you're behaving.
Oh,
that does not mean that's who you are. Behavior
yeah.
is different than who we are.
That's
and you
true.
Can always change your behavior. A lot of people try and say, well, you know, if I really changed that behavior, I wouldn't be me anymore. Yes, you would be you. It's just you're changing this behavior that is hurtful to other people.
Yeah.
So I think separating behavior, it mm-hmm. does not need to define us.
That's true.
We don't, you know, don't let it define you if you're a certain way and think, oh, I can't change. So I really believe that as we age, I do think it's important to be more flexible. Now, what does happen with some,
mm-hmm.
maybe a lot of older people, is they become more rigid, which I think is what you were pointing out. I think that is common.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, I mean, I can't help thinking of, you know, Curtis's late grandma. She was 93 years old when she passed away. And man, she just said what she thought. And it was fantastic. It was very amusing.
Well, did you think she thought it was a good trait of hers? Like, is that what she thought?
I just don't think she cared. I mean, she had no filter. And it's not that she wasn't rude, right? Like, she didn't say rude things about people. Well, at least in general. But, you know, I mean, she said what was on her mind and she just said it like it was, you know,
okay.
And she would just say the best things ever.
But Liz, you just said something kind of important. As we age, I think, you know, the cognitive decline I think it makes it hard to filter. And so it could be that she just lost her ability to filter what's coming into her head.
That's a very good point. But man, she said some things that just like goals. Just awesome. Okay, so another area of cognitive dissonance that I thought might be interesting to discuss, and that is criminals and how criminals experience cognitive dissonance. And maybe they've just found a way to rationalize or justify their experience. But I mean, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, you know, because a lot of times criminals, they'll keep doing the same thing over and over until they get caught. And obviously they know it's wrong because it's illegal.
Well, there's certainly there's a certain amount of justification that goes on. Like,
yeah,
these people don't deserve what they have. I do, that type of thing. But if you look at antisocial personality disorder or sociopaths, let's call them, that in the past, there was a belief that they just didn't have that circuitry in the brain that allowed them to feel empathy.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if you think about any criminal act, there's really a lack of empathy. Even if I'm going into the store and stealing something, you're stealing from someone, you're decreasing someone's income or something, you know, you're affecting someone. And so the thought was at the time that, you know, little or no empathy. What I've read recently is there's a change in how people are thinking about that, that they actually have empathy. They just make the choice to not follow the empathy and just do the behavior that they know is wrong, illegal. And so it becomes a choice more than anything. But your question, do they experience cognitive dissonance? I don't know about that. I don't know enough about it.
Right.
But I think it's interesting to think that maybe it's not about empathy at all.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's more these people are able. Well, maybe they're able. Okay, here's the thought. This is just the thought I'm going to throw out. Maybe they're really able to push aside the cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
Whereas someone else, that would make a difference. But to them, it probably doesn't.
Right. And so I'm wondering, too, if maybe they feel disgust differently than others. So I wonder if it has to do with their amygdala, like their amygdalary response.
Well, it could be. And so that goes back to, you know, what I said first, that it's more tied into empathy.
Right. Yeah.
But, you know, the current thinking is trending more toward, no, they have, you know, their amygdala is fine. They just make choices to override.
And
there's a rationalization of some sort going on.
Yeah. And I think, too, it kind of depends on the type of criminal or the type of crime. So, I mean, I think a good example is like if you think of somebody who is embezzling money, oftentimes it starts out as just as a small thing, right? Or Curtis told me this story once of somebody who in who got in a lot of trouble. I think he might even face criminal charges for it. So he had a company credit card and he was out on a business trip and there was some small expense that he justified. He's like, oh, well, this is just a business expense, right? And he justified this business expense. But then it just kept escalating and escalating and escalating. And it kept going farther and farther until he was justifying more and more and more.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think there's that kind of thing that happens, you know, gradually where it's like, well, I mean, a couple dollars doesn't make a difference. And then, you know, before you know it, you're stealing thousands of dollars from a company. And then there's also the type of people who, you know, will just, I mean, they'll just flat out rob somebody at gunpoint, right? So I think there's differences. And so, you know, you think of the cognitive dissonance for somebody who is like, who starts out small and then it grows bigger. You would think maybe they are having a different response than somebody who just, I don't know, or just.
Right. I think it's more rationalization. Oh, you know, this money isn't going to be missed or something like that. And so, you know, this organization has a lot of money. They aren't going to miss this. I need that type of thing.
Yeah, right. Or, you know, or maybe even someone who is like, if they're stealing to try to live, right? I mean, I think, you know, that's got to create some cognitive dissonance. But, I mean, you know, I think that's different than somebody who just thinks, I just want it, right? Like, I just... or they get a thrill, or maybe that's another interesting thing to discuss, is people who get a thrill from shoplifting.
Well, there are certainly people who do that, you know, so they're getting some dopamine rush by doing it.
So, I mean, do they have any sort of cognitive dissonance? Like, there's got to be some sort of disconnect there.
Yeah, no, I'm sure they do. You know, it's interesting that you chose this topic just because it's not something that's talked about very often. And so, but it would be really interesting. You're bringing up a lot of interesting questions. So you ought to write this down because there's probably a dissertation in this.
Oh, yeah. That's a good idea. I could do my PhD dissertation on cognitive dissonance
and crime.
Criminal and crime. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Okay. So next week we are going to get into what causes anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to get into specifically how anxiety happens in the brain. And we're going to talk about what people think is causing anxiety versus what is actually causing anxiety.
And in the body. So,
yes.
For me, anxiety is the physical manifestation of the fear or worry, which is taking place in the brain. So,
yeah.
And we've talked about anxiety before. It's good to revisit it.
Yes. Well, it's very, very common.
Common. So. Yeah.
Yep. All right. So we will see you all next week.
Goodbye, everyone.
Have a question for Dr. Burton? How about a topic you'd like us to cover? Send us an email at mentalhealthpod21@gmail.com. This podcast was produced and edited by Liz Lang. Music is by Audio Lounge.